Usually when we talk about something like a medical diagnosis, there is this immense expectation of just pure precision. Like it's almost like structural engineering,
Oh,
really.
absolutely.
Like you fall off a bike, you break your arm, and you go in, and the X-ray machine prints out that stark black and white image, and the doctor points to that jagged white line on the bone and just says, "Well, there it is. That's the fracture."
Right. It is binary. I mean, it is completely clear cut. And psychologically, that is incredibly comforting for us. We want things to be visible like that.
Yeah, we want the flaws to be right there in front of us.
Exactly. We want the flaws in the system to be perfectly categorized so we can just, apply a specific known fix and move on.
But then you take a step away from the physical world and you walk into the world of enterprise cybersecurity, and suddenly that beautiful, precise X-ray machine is completely broken.
Oh, it's shattered.
Right. We are no longer looking at a neat black and white image. We're looking at this landscape of digital identities and network access that is, well, honestly, it's just murky. I mean, you cannot see in plain sight who is actually sitting behind the screen typing on that keyboard halfway across the world.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters, for sure.
Yeah.
When you are dealing with access governance and password security, you're dealing with what is basically a fundamental philosophical problem, but it's disguised as a technical one.
Oh, I like how you phrased that, a philosophical problem.
And because how do you mathematically and systematically prove that the entity attempting to log into a server is like the legitimate human being who actually owns that account and not, a script or a bot or some malicious actor with a stolen credential?
Exactly. The stakes literally couldn't be higher, and the mechanisms we use to figure this out are completely invisible to the average user. And that is the exact dilemma we are unpacking today. So, welcome to week six of your syllabus. For our deep dive today, the title and our core mission is Access Governance at Password Hashing, basically asking the question, who holds the key?
Right. And for this session, which is customized specifically for you as you move through your week six coursework, we are synthesizing a truly massive stack of sources. I mean, it's a lot.
It is a massive stack. We are pulling directly from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, specifically looking at their formal historical specifications on role-based access control.
Yeah. And we are also layering that foundational theory with modern cryptographic guides. Contemporary enterprise security frameworks, most notably the NIST Cybersecurity Framework 2.0, and various specialized cybersecurity training manuals. So it really is a comprehensive look at how we build these digital fortresses today.
It's a lot of ground to cover. But I promise the logic flows beautifully once you see it all laid out. We are going to explore how a computer system knows who you are, how it decides what you are allowed to touch once you are inside, and how it protects the ultimate secret, which is your password.
It's basically like designing the security for a multi-billion-dollar high-security research facility.
Yes, exactly. Let's use that analogy. So, getting through the front gate of that facility requires one specific set of rules, right? Maybe you swipe a badge, or maybe the guard checks your face against a database that gets you into the lobby.
Right, but taking the elevator down to the subterranean server room or, accessing the CEO's private safe, that requires an entirely different, much stricter set of rules.
And that analogy right there sets up the most critical distinction in all of access governance. We really have to draw a hard line between two concepts that sound incredibly similar, and they honestly often get conflated in casual conversation, but they serve entirely different architectural
I
purposes.
know exactly where you're going with this. Authentication versus authorization.
That's the one. And in the cybersecurity industry, just to avoid tripping over the syllables constantly, we abbreviate these as authen and authz.
Authen and authc. It saves a lot of breath in meetings, let me tell you.
I bet. So let's start the front door with authentication. Authen is the act of proving your identity. It is the system asking, are you really who you claim to be?
Exactly. When you type your username, you are basically making a claim of identity. You're saying, hey, I am employee number 405.
Right.
And then the password, or maybe a fingerprint scan or a one-time code sent to your mobile phone that is the proof of that claim.
Got it. So authentication is strictly about identity verification. It doesn't care what you want to do once you're inside. It literally only cares that you are who you say you are.
Spot on. Now, authorization or authz is the sequential next step. It happens exclusively after auth and successful. You can't authorize someone who isn't authenticated yet.
Okay, so once you are authenticated and standing inside the digital lobby, so to speak, authz defines your boundaries.
Right. It answers the question, do you actually have the right permissions to view or edit or execute or delete this specific file or system resource.
So to lean on another analogy, if often is the bouncer at the front door of a nightclub checking your ID to make sure you are over 21 and matching your face to the photo, Auth-Z is the velvet rope bouncer inside the club.
Oh, love that. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Because that second bouncer, they don't care about your ID anymore. They are just checking if you have the VIP wristband required to enter the VIP lounge.
That captures the sequential nature of it perfectly. And this separation isn't just some theoretical academic thing. It is heavily mandated by modern security standards.
Yeah, like the NIST guidelines we mentioned.
Exactly. If we look at the NIST Cybersecurity Framework 2.0, which is basically the gold standard for how organizations should structure their defenses, we see this explicitly laid out in the Protect function.
Right, specifically under the Identity Management, Authentication, and Access Control category.
Yes, they defined a series of subcategories there, PRAA01 through PRAA05.
But let's not just list those out like a textbook. Let's talk about the evolution there, because these guidelines didn't just appear out of thin air. They were written in direct response to how systems used to completely fail. What is the core progression NIST is demanding here?
Well, the progression basically moves from just establishing the existence of an identity to fiercely protecting the context of that identity. So PRAA01 starts by mandating that identities and credentials for users and services and even hardware devices must be formally managed by the organization.
So no rogue undocumented accounts floating around.
Exactly. You have to know who is in the system.
Right.
But PRAA02 is where it really gets fascinating. It requires that identities are proofed and bound to credentials based on the context of interactions.
The context of interactions. Now, why was that specific language added? Because I assume just having the right username and password isn't enough anymore, right?
Precisely. Historically, if you had the password, the system just blindly assumed you were the user. But what if a hacker on the other side of the planet steals your password? Under old models, the system would just let them right in.
Because it only checked the credential, not the context.
Right. But PRAA02 says we must look at the context. Is this login attempt coming from the user's usual corporate laptop? Is it coming from a recognized geographic location?
Ah, okay.
If the context doesn't match the identity, the authentication should be challenged, regardless of whether the password is correct.
That makes total sense. And then PRAA03 strictly states that everything must be authenticated, and PRAA04 says those identity assertions must be cryptographically protected and verified. Which leads us directly to PRAA05, and this is where we cross the line from Authen into Auth-Z, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
PRAA05 is the authorization mandate. It states that access permissions and entitlements must be defined in a policy, strictly managed, enforced, and regularly reviewed. And most importantly, it mandates two foundational security philosophies, the principle of least privilege and the separation of duties.
Okay, let's break this down. The principle of least privilege. In plain English, that means you only get the absolute minimum access, just the bare minimum permissions required to do your specific job.
Yeah.
And literally nothing more.
Exactly.
So if your job is to read the quarterly reports, you are granted read access. You are never granted edit or delete access just in case you make a mistake, or worse, in case your account gets compromised.
Right. It shrinks the blast radius if something goes wrong. And then separation of duties ensures that no single individual has enough permissions to execute a critical, potentially damaging process from end to end.
Oh, give me an example of that.
Well, for example, the person who submits an expense report cannot be the same person who approves the expense report. The Auth-Z system must actively prevent that overlap in permissions.
To make this tangible for you listening, let's look at how this physically operates at the system level. If we look at Linux, which is the operating system that runs a massive chunk of the internet servers, it handles the separation very cleanly.
It really does.
Every single file on a Linux system has built-in authorization flags using three distinct levels, right? User, group, and other.
Right. The classic read, write, and execute permissions. The user is typically the individual who created the file. The group is a defined subset of users who share a specific need to access it, maybe the engineering team. And other is literally everyone else on the system.
So when you log into the Linux server, that's Auth-N. But the moment you try to open a text file, the Linux kernel acts as the Auth-Z bouncer. It checks your identity against those three categories and either opens the file or it throws a big permission denied error.
Exactly. And the way we handle this over the internet has evolved dramatically, too. If we look at older web technologies, the way we used to do this was through something called HTTP Basic Auth.
Oh, man. Which, looking back, was a terrifying way to design a system.
It really was.
With HTTP Basic Auth, every single time you clicked a link or requested an image on a secured website, your browser would take your username and your password, package them up, and literally send them over the network again.
Over and over.
Yeah. Sometimes they were completely in clear text, or sometimes they were just lightly encoded using something called Base64, which, I mean, any basic computer program can instantly decode.
It offered zero real protection.
Right. So if a malicious actor was eavesdropping on the network traffic, say, on a public coffee shop Wi-Fi, they could just pluck your password right out of the air.
You were essentially flashing your social security card and your passport every single time you wanted to open a new door inside the building.
Mm.
It was an unacceptable exposure of the Authn credential just to achieve AuthZ.
Which is exactly why modern systems use API tokens instead. And this is where the architecture gets genuinely brilliant. Protocols like OAuth completely separate the credential from the authorization. With Oath, you don't hand your password to a third-party application at all. You authenticate once, securely, usually with a central identity provider like Google or Microsoft.
And upon successful authentication, that provider issues a token. Think of an API token as a digitally signed temporary hall pass.
A hall pass? I like that.
Yeah. It is a small block of data, often structured as a JSON web token, or JWT. This token contains cryptographic proof of your identity, but way more importantly, it contains specific scopes or permissions.
So the token says, I am John Doe, and I am authorized to read the email inbox, but I am not authorized to send emails. And I hand that token to the application rather than handing over my actual password.
Exactly. The application verifies the mathematical signature on the token to ensure it hasn't been tampered with.
Yeah.
And then it just grants you the access to find in those specific scopes. Your actual password never touches the third-party server. We have successfully separated proving who you are from proving what you can do.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. If we have these brilliant systems, if Authn is rigorously checking context, and AuthZ is using perfectly scoped cryptographic tokens enforcing least privilege, why are we constantly reading headlines about massive enterprise systems getting breached? Like, why does the system fail if the velvet rope bouncers are all in place?
See, that is the multi-million-dollar question in the industry. And the uncomfortable truth is that the failure usually isn't in the mathematics of the cryptography. The math works fine. The failure is in the scale of human administration.
Human error.
Basically.
Mm.
Authorization rules simply become too massive and too messy to manage on an individual basis.
Give me a sense of that scale. Like, how bad does it get?
Well, imagine a mid-sized enterprise with, say, 5,000 employees. They have thousands of servers, hundreds of databases, millions of individual files, and dozens of internal applications. If the IT department has to sit there and manually assign individual read, write, and execute permissions to every single file for every single one of those 5,000 employees. I mean, human error isn't just a possibility, it is a statistical guarantee.
Right, because the enterprise isn't static. People get hired, they get fired, they move to different departments.
Exactly. And that leads to the most common vulnerability, which is privilege creep.
Privilege creep.
Yeah. Let's say you have a software developer working in quality assurance. They need deep root-level access to the testing servers to do their job. A year later, they get promoted to a production management role.
Good for them.
Right. And the IT department diligently adds the new production permissions to their account so they can do their new job. But because the system is a tangled, unmanageable web, they completely forget to revoke the old QA permissions.
And over 5 years, this employee just accumulates the keys to every single kingdom they've ever worked in.
Yep.
So if a hacker breaches that one employee's account, they suddenly have catastrophic god-level access across the entire company network.
That is the administrative nightmare of assigning permissions directly to individuals. To fix this, the security industry had to completely change its philosophy. They realized they had to stop managing human beings and start managing job functions.
Which leads us directly into the architectural solution and section 2 of our deep dive. Structuring access with role-based access control, universally known as RBAC.
To truly grasp why RBAC changed everything, we have to look back at the foundational literature, specifically the proposed MIST standard for role-based access control. This was pioneered by researchers like David Ferriolo and Ravi Sandhu back in the early 1990s.
Okay.
Before their work, systems mostly relied on discretionary access control, where the creator of a file decided who got to see it, or mandatory access control, which is highly rigid and used mostly by the military.
Neither of which worked for a dynamic, fast-moving modern corporation.
Exactly. Ferraiolo and Sandu recognize that in a commercial enterprise, access shouldn't be based on who owns the file, nor should it be based on top-secret security clearances. Access should be based solely on what your job title requires you to do. So they proposed a formal mathematical model to standardize how software should handle this, defining five core elements.
Let's break those five elements down, because understanding this vocabulary is absolute key to understanding the mechanism. First, we have users.
Right.
In the NIST model, a user is traditionally defined as a human being, though in modern cloud environments, a user can absolutely be an automated machine, a script, or an intelligent agent acting on behalf of a system.
Right. Non-human identities are huge now. Second, we have roles. A role is a job function or a title within the organization. It carries specific semantics regarding the authority and responsibility conferred on whoever holds that title. So a role is senior accountant or help desk technician or night shift supervisor.
Got it. Third are the objects, which are sometimes called resources. These are the actual digital entities being protected. They can be information containers, like a specific text file, an entire database, or even a single row within a customer table.
Yeah.
Or they can be exhaustible physical resources, like a networked printer or a specific amount of server disk space.
That's right. Fourth, we have operations. These are the executable actions a computer can perform. Depending on what the object is, the operation could be to read the data, write new data, execute a script, or append a new record.
And finally, the fifth element, which ties the previous two together, permissions. A permission is simply an approval to perform a specific operation on a specific object. For example, read, which is the operation in the Q3 financials file, which is the object.
Now, here is where the absolute brilliance of the NIST RBAC standard comes into play. How do you link these five elements together without creating that tangled web of privilege creep we discussed earlier? You use what database architects call many-to-many relationships.
Oh, this is the good stuff.
Specifically, RBAC relies on two critical mappings, the user assignment relation and the permission assignment relation.
Let's unpack the math of that many-to-many concept for the listener, because it really is the secret sauce of the whole framework. In a many-to-many setup, a single user can be assigned to many different roles. But simultaneously, a single role can contain many different users.
And the same logic applies to the other side of the equation. A single role can be assigned many different permissions, and a single permission can be attached to many different roles.
Visually, it creates this beautiful abstraction layer right in the middle. You are no longer drawing a direct line from John Doe to the Q3 financials file.
No, never.
Instead, you draw a line from John Doe to the accountant role. Separately, you draw a line from the account role to the read Q3 financials permission.
It completely revolutionizes onboarding and offboarding. Mm-hmm. Think about it. When John Doe leaves the company, IT doesn't have to hunt down the thousands of individual files he had access to. They simply sever the single user assignment link between John Doe and the accountant role. The permission assignment links between the role and the actual files remain perfectly intact for all the other accountants still working there.
I love to use the starter kit analogy to explain this. Imagine it is your first day at a new corporate job. Under the old system, you would have to spend your first week walking around to different departments, basically begging, right? Asking for the physical key to the supply closet, asking IT for the passcode to the third floor printer, and submitting support tickets to get licenses for your software. It is horribly inefficient.
But under RBAC, the HR department just hands you a prepackaged box labeled Marketing Team Starter Kit. That box automatically contains the closet key, the printer code, and the software licenses. You don't ask for permissions individually. You are granted a role, and the permissions are inherent to the role.
It is incredibly elegant. But there is another concept in core RBAC that I feel like a lot of enterprise implementations actually forget to use properly, and that is the concept of sessions. How do sessions factor into this NIST model?
Sessions are absolutely vital for enforcing the principle of least privilege we talked about earlier. In core RBAC, when a user successfully authenticates and logs in, they instantiate a session.
Okay.
A session is a temporary mapping between the user and an actively selected subset of the roles they hold.
Wait, a subset? So if I am assigned five different roles in the corporate directory, they aren't all active the second I log in?
They shouldn't be if the system is designed correctly.
Okay.
Let's say you are the director of IT. You hold the standard employee role, which lets you check your email and view the cafeteria menu. But you also hold the domain admin role, which allows you to delete entire databases and reconfigure firewalls. If you are logging in at 9 a.m. just to read an HR newsletter, you do not need your domain admin powers.
Right, because if I am reading my email with domain admin powers active and I accidentally click a sophisticated phishing link, the malware that executes in my browser suddenly inherits my domain admin permissions and destroys the whole network.
Exactly. The malware operates with whatever privileges are active in that specific session. By forcing you to log in with only your employee role active, the session restricts your capabilities and protects you. If you need to reconfigure a firewall later in the day, you must actively request the system to elevate your session or spawn a new session with the domain admin role specifically enabled. It intentionally shrinks the attack surface.
So it's essentially like the sudo command in Linux, where you have to explicitly ask for super user powers for one specific command, rather than running as the super user all day and risking a typo destroying everything.
That is the exact mechanism. RBAC organizes the chaos beautifully. It provides structure, predictability, and auditability.
It sounds like the perfect system.
Yeah.
But if we are looking at the evolution of access governance, I know RBAC eventually hits a wall. The starter kits stop working when the rules become too complex. Which brings us to section 3, adding context. The battle between RBAC and attribute-based access control, or ABAC. Where exactly does RBAC break down?
Well, RBAC begins to break down, or rather it collapses under its own weight, when an organization's access policies become highly situational or context-dependent. The industry term for this failure state is role explosion.
Role explosion. Walk me through how a perfectly good RBAC system explodes.
Let's map out a hypothetical corporate scenario. You have a global enterprise and you create a logical role called finance manager. Everyone with that title gets the finance manager starter kit. It works perfectly.
Sounds good so far.
But then new international privacy laws are passed, like GDPR in Europe. The legal department tells IT, hey, finance managers in Asia are no longer legally allowed to view the customer financial data of European citizens.
Okay, so a single finance manager role doesn't work anymore because they don't all share the same permissions based on where they are.
Precisely. Yeah. So IT splits the role. They create finance manager Asia and finance manager Europe. That is totally manageable. Two roles instead of one. But a month later, HR implements a new policy. They state that temporary contractors cannot have access to the long-term strategic forecasting files that full-time employees use.
Oh, I see where this is going. Now IT has to split the roles again based on employment type. So we have finance manager Asia full-time, finance manager Asia contractor, finance manager Europe full-time, and finance manager Europe contractor. We just went from one role to four.
And it doesn't stop there. Next, the security team dictates that because of recent cyber threats, sensitive financial databases can only be accessed during a user's officially scheduled shift. Shift 1, shift 2, or shift 3.
This is a nightmare. So if I'm an IT admin, I now have to create a role explicitly named Finance Manager Asia Contractor Shift 2.
Yes. You have to mathematically calculate the Cartesian product of every single regional, departmental, employment, and temporal variable in the entire company. Suddenly, an organization with 5,000 employees doesn't have 50 manageable roles. They have 15,000 hyper-specific fragmented roles. And we are right back to the administrative chaos that RBAC was originally invented to solve.
So when the starter kits become too complicated to prepackage like that, what is the solution? How do we actually fix role explosion?
We abandon the concept of static roles and move to a dynamic evaluation model called attribute-based access control, or ABV. Instead of assigning a user to a rigid list of permissions, ABAC grants or denies access in real time by evaluating a set of dynamic attributes across three distinct categories.
I am guessing the first category has to do with the identity of the person themselves.
Yes, the first category is user attributes. This pulls data typically from an Active Directory. It includes the user's name, their department, their official job title, their security clearance level, or their employment status.
That makes sense. And the second category would have to focus on what they're trying to touch.
Correct. The second category is resource attributes. The policy engine evaluates the object itself. What is the data classification of this file? Is it labeled public, internal, confidential, strictly top secret? Who is the original creator of the record? Which geographic region does the data belong to?
Okay, so user and resource. But the third category is the one that really sets ABAC apart, isn't it?
It is the absolute game changer.
Yeah.
The third category is environmental attributes. This looks at the broader context of the access request in that specific millisecond.
Wow, millisecond.
Yeah, it checks the system clock to see the time of day. It checks the network logs to see the user's IP address and geographic location. It checks the security posture of the device, like is the laptop running the latest antivirus update?
Let's bring this to life with a highly localized, vivid scenario so you listening can really see the mechanics of this. Imagine an employee trying to access the company's central payroll database. Under a strict RBAC system, if that employee has the HR manager role, they click the database, the system checks their role, and they are in. It literally doesn't care about anything else.
Right. It is a blind approval based purely on title. But under an ABAC architecture, the system is vastly more intelligent.
Right.
The access policy isn't a static link. It is a complex logical Boolean equation. The central policy engine might have a rule written in a language like XACML that says allow access equals true if user department equals HR and agree source type equals payroll data and environment time is between 0800 and 1700 hours and environment of pleep location equals corporate head office intranet.
So all those conditions must evaluate to true simultaneously, which means if that exact same legitimate HR manager decides to leave the office, go to a 24-hour coffee shop at 2 a.m., open their laptop on a public Wi-Fi network, and try to log into the payroll system to catch up on work, what actually happens under the hood?
The ABAC policy enforcement point intercepts the request. It queries the user directory and confirms, yes, this person is an HR manager. It checks the resource. Yes, this is payroll data.
Right.
But then it checks the environmental attributes. The time is 2 a.m., which falls outside the permitted 0800 to 1700 window. The IP address resolves to a public ISP, not the corporate intranet. The equation returns a false. The access is instantly blocked.
Even though their auth and credentials were perfect and their job title is correct, the environmental context triggered the auth-Z denial. That is incredibly powerful for preventing data exfiltration or insider threats.
Absolutely.
But I have to push back here on the architecture. If ABAC is this smart, this dynamic, and this perfectly tailored, why does anyone still use RBAC? Why wouldn't every single company on Earth just ditch RBAC tomorrow and migrate entirely to ABAC?
Because of the massive, often crippling computational and administrative overhead that ABAC introduces, you really have to think about what the computer processor is actually doing behind the scenes.
Break that processing down for me. Why is it so heavy?
Think about RBAC. In RBAC, when you request a file, the server performs a simple split-second database lookup. It checks a table. Does user A have role B, yes or no? It takes a fraction of a millisecond. It requires almost zero processing power.
Right. It's just checking a pre-calculated list.
But in a pure ABAC environment, nothing is pre-calculated. Every single time a user clicks a file or opens a database row, the policy decision point has to wake up. It has to send a network request to the HR database to fetch user attributes. It has to send a request to the file system to fetch resource attributes. It has to query the network router for IP data.
Wow, that's a lot of queries.
And it has to pull all that data into memory, parse complex IF then logic scripts, evaluate the conditions, and only then make a decision.
And if an enterprise has thousands of employees opening tens of thousands of files every single minute, doing that heavy dynamic calculation for every single click would just bring the server infrastructure to its knees.
Exactly. The network latency alone would make the system completely unusable. Plus, writing, debugging, and maintaining those complex logical policies requires highly specialized security architects. If you write an ABAC rule poorly, you might accidentally lock the entire company out of the billing system.
So it is a massive trade-off between absolute granular precision and actual system performance. So where does that leave a modern enterprise? What is the actual best practice today?
The industry standard today is a hybrid approach. You don't choose between them, you layer them. You use RBAC to establish the broad baseline permissions, what we call coarse-grained access control.
Okay.
You give the person the HR manager role, which mathematically grants them basic visibility into the HR server. It gets them through the front doors of the department with minimal processing overhead.
And then?
Then you layer ABAC exclusively over the most sensitive assets to provide fine-grained access control. The RBAC role lets them into the HR software, but when they try to specifically open the highly sensitive executive compensation spreadsheet, the ABAC engine kicks in, evaluating their location, time, and device security before granting that final millimeter of access.
So RBAC is the bouncer that gets you into the building quickly, and ABAC is the vault timer that checks the clock and your biometric pulse before letting you actually open the safe.
That is the perfect way to visualize the hybrid model. But here is the critical pivot point of this entire architectural discussion. Whether you are using the simplest Linux group permissions, a masterfully crafted RBAC many-to-many matrix, or the most advanced, context-aware ABAC engine on the planet, every single one of those authorization rules relies entirely on one massive assumption.
That the initial auth and step verifying the identity was accurate.
Yes. If I am a hacker, and I managed to successfully log in as you, the system is completely blind to the deception. It will happily apply all of your RBAC roles to me. It will dynamically evaluate my session and grant me your ABAC attributes. I'll perfectly inherit your digital life. And how do we primarily prove identity to initiate that offense step?
By verifying a password.
Exactly. Which means this entire multi-million-dollar access governance fortress rests entirely on a single foundational pillar: how safely the database stores and verifies your password. If the password storage is compromised, the entire Auth-Z structure collapses instantly.
Which takes us to the absolute core of our discussion, Section 4, the core secret database password security. We really need to talk about cryptography. Specifically, we have to unpack the profound difference between encryption and hashing.
This is perhaps the most misunderstood concept in basic cybersecurity. I mean, even in professional meetings, you will hear developers or managers use the phrase hash encryption. We have to eradicate that term from our vocabulary right now. Hashing and encryption are not two flavors of the same thing. They're fundamentally, mathematically, completely different cryptographic operations designed for completely different purposes.
Okay, let's draw a hard line in the sand. Let's start with two-way encryption. How does it work and what is it actually for?
Two-way encryption encompasses symmetric algorithms like Advanced Encryption Standard or AES, where the same key locks and unlocks the data, in asymmetric algorithms like RSA, which uses a public key to lock and a private key to unlock.
Right.
But regardless of the specific algorithm, the defining mandatory characteristic of encryption is that it is reversible.
Reversible, meaning if you take a readable document and scramble it into a mess of random characters, the mathematics allow you to perfectly unscramble it back to the original document.
Precisely. The overarching goal of encryption is confidentiality. It is designed to hide information from unauthorized eyes while in transit or at rest, with the explicit intention that an authorized person will read it later.
Read it later.
Yeah. If you possess the correct decryption key, you can reverse the mathematical cipher and turn the ciphertext back into plain text. We use encryption every time we connect to a website via HTTPS or when we encrypt a hard drive with BitLocker. The system needs to read the data eventually, so it must be reversible.
Okay, that makes perfect sense for documents or network traffic. But what about one-way cryptographic hashing? How does it differ?
Hashing relies on algorithms like SHA-256, which stands for Secure Hash Algorithm. The defining characteristic of a hash function is that it is strictly mathematically irreversible.
Irreversible. So it's a one-way street. Once you scramble it, you can never, ever unscramble it.
Never. Because the goal of hashing is not confidentiality. Hashing does not care about hiding a secret message so it can be read later. The goal of hashing is integrity and verification. A hash function takes an input of literally any size. You could input a four-letter password, or you could input the entire text of the Encyclopedia Britannica, or a 50-gigabyte 4K video file.
Okay.
The algorithm processes that data through complex modular arithmetic, bitwise operations, and nonlinear functions, and crushes it down into a single fixed-length string of characters.
Wait, so no matter how big the input is, the output is always the exact same size. So in the case of SHA-256, it's always just a 64-character hexadecimal string.
Exactly. We call that output a hash value, a digest, or, most intuitively, a digital fingerprint. And it is crucial to understand that you cannot decrypt a hash. There is no key that exists anywhere in the universe that can reverse the math and turn that 64-character fingerprint back into the 50-gigabyte video file. The information is intentionally lost during the compression.
And what makes this useful is a fascinating mathematical behavior known as the avalanche effect, right? Explain how the avalanche effect ensures verification.
The avalanche effect dictates that if you change even one single microscopic bit of data in the input, the resulting hash output will be completely, randomly, and unpredictably different.
So it's like a cryptographic butterfly effect.
Yes, exactly. If you hash the word password written with a lowercase p, you get a very specific 64-character string starting with 588. But if you change just the first letter to a capital P, making it password, the output doesn't just change the first character, the algorithm avalanches. Every single character in the 64-character output scrambles into something entirely unrecognizable. It won't look even remotely similar to the first hash.
Okay, so bringing this back to our Authn Foundation, what does this mean for how an enterprise database handles our credentials? Why do security experts scream that you must hash passwords instead of encrypting them?
It basically comes down to key management and the assumption of breach. A database must never, ever store raw, plaintext passwords. If an administrator can open a database table and read your actual password, that company is committing a catastrophic security failure. But paradoxically, you shouldn't encrypt them either.
Wait, why not? If AES encryption is considered military grade and unbreakable without the key, why is it bad for passwords?
Because of the key. If you encrypt the passwords, the server needs the decryption key to verify them when users log in. Where does the server store that key? Usually in a configuration file or in the application's environment variables, sitting right next to the database on the exact same server.
Oh, wow.
If a hacker breaches your network and gains access to the database, they will almost certainly find the decryption key as well. And once they have the key, they just run the decryption script, and suddenly they have a plain text list of every single password in your company.
So the encryption is really only as safe as the key, and the key has to live on the server to be useful. So we eliminate the key entirely. We use hashing.
Yes. We store the hash. When you first sign up for an account and type in your new password, the server immediately hashes it. It throws away the real password entirely and saves that 64-character fixed-length fingerprint in the database instead.
Then what happens a week later when I come back and try to log in? How does the server know my password is correct if it only has the fingerprint?
When you type your password into the login box, the system takes the plain text you just submitted, runs it through the exact same one-way hashing algorithm in real time, and generates a new fingerprint. It then compares this new fingerprint to the fingerprint stored in the database.
Okay, I see.
If the two fingerprints match character for character, the server mathematically knows that you typed the correct password. It verified the truth of the input without the system ever actually knowing or storing what the password is.
I love that concept. It is verification without knowledge. Let me offer a physical analogy to really cement the difference between encryption and hashing for you listening. Think of two-way encryption, like translating a highly sensitive document into an obscure, dead language. It is unreadable to anyone who intercepts it. But if you possess the translation dictionary, which is the key, you can easily translate it back into English and read the original words. That is encryption.
And how would you visualize hashing?
Hashing is like taking that same highly sensitive document and dropping it into a high-powered industrial meat grinder. The document is shredded, pulverized, and compressed into an unrecognizable pile of pulp. You cannot ever take that pile of pulp and reconstruct the original document. It is physically and mathematically impossible. The data is completely destroyed.
But it retains its unique properties.
Exactly. If someone comes to you claiming they have a copy of the original document, you don't need to read it. You just drop their document into the exact same meat grinder. If their document produces a pile of pulp that weighs exactly the same, has the exact same texture, and looks exactly identical to your stored pile of pulp, you have verified that their document is identical to the original. You verify the input by comparing the destroyed outputs.
That is a very vivid, slightly terrifying, but highly accurate analogy. You verify the input without ever needing to reverse the output.
But wait, let's follow the logic of this meat grinder for a second. If hashing is a one-way street and it is impossible to decrypt a hash, then our Authend Foundation is perfectly safe, right? If a hacker breaches the database and steals the millions of hash fingerprints, they can't reverse them to read the password, so we don't even need to worry about database leaks.
Unfortunately, no. That is a dangerous, incredibly naive assumption that has led to the downfall of thousands of companies. Which leads us directly into the darker reality of Section 5, cracking the hash vulnerabilities of raw hashing.
Okay, let's explore this threat scenario deeply. Let's say a hacker discovers a vulnerability in a company's web application. Maybe it's a SQL injection where the hacker types malicious database commands into the username field, confusing the server into dumping its entire database. The hacker successfully downloads a massive table containing millions of usernames and their corresponding irreversible hashes.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't the users safe?
Because cryptography is perfect, but human psychology is deeply flawed. The vulnerability isn't in the math, it is in a concept called password entropy.
Entropy, like in physics, it means chaos or disorder. How does it apply to passwords?
Well, in information security, entropy is the mathematical measure of how unpredictable something is. A high entropy password is long, complex, completely random, and therefore virtually impossible to guess. A string of 20 random alphanumeric characters has massive entropy, but humans have terrible memories. We hate high entropy. We crave low entropy. We use passwords like 123456, or literally the word password, or the name of our favorite sports team followed by the year we were born.
And because humans are predictable, attackers can exploit that predictability against a hashed database. How do they actually do it?
Through dictionary attacks and brute force operations. Remember, the attacker has the stolen database of hashes sitting on their own computer now. They don't need to reverse your hash. They just build their own meat grinder.
Walk me through the mechanics of a dictionary attack.
The attacker downloads a massive text file, a dictionary containing millions of common words, phrases, pop culture references, and passwords leaked from previous historical breaches. They run a cracking program that takes the first word in the dictionary, hashes it, and compares the result to every hash in your stolen database. If there's no match, it moves to the second word, hashes it, and compares.
But doing that one by one sounds like it would take forever.
It would if they were using a standard computer processor, a CPU. But attackers don't use CPUs for this. They use arrays of high-end graphics cards, or GPUs.
Graphics cards? Like the ones teenagers use to play video games in 4K. Why are graphics cards good at hacking passwords?
Because of their physical architecture. A CPU is like a few highly intelligent professors. It has maybe 4 or 8 cores that can handle very complex tasks sequentially. But a GPU is designed to calculate the color and lighting of millions of individual pixels on a screen simultaneously. A modern GPU has thousands of tiny, simple cores arithmetic logic units. They are designed for massive parallel processing.
So instead of hashing one dictionary word at a time, the GPU hashes 10,000 dictionary words at the exact same time.
Exactly. A standard gaming GPU can perform billions of SHA-256 hash calculations per second. If your password is anywhere in their dictionary, they will find the matching hash and thus know your password in a fraction of a second. But even with billions of hashes a second, brute forcing complex passwords takes time. So attackers developed an even more terrifying hyper-efficient method. They use something called rainbow tables.
Rainbow tables. This is a legendary concept in cybersecurity. But to understand why a rainbow table works, we first need to take a detour and understand a mathematical concept called the birthday paradox, right?
Yes. The birthday paradox perfectly illustrates probability and the likelihood of hash collisions. The paradox asks a simple question. How many people do you need to put in a room before there's a 50% probability that two people share the exact same birthday?
Intuitively, because there are 365 days in a year, human instinct tells us we need half that amount, maybe 180 people, to get a 50% chance of a match.
But human intuition is terrible at exponential probability. The actual mathematical answer is just 23 people. In a room of just 23 people, there is a greater than 50% chance of a match.
That's wild. Why is it so low?
Because you aren't just comparing one person to everyone else. Every single person is being compared to every other person. The number of possible pairings grows exponentially with each new person added to the room. By the time you reach 70 people, there is a 99.9% chance of a shared birthday.
So how does this paradox apply to a hacker staring at a database of hashed passwords?
Well, attackers understand that out of a database of a million users, thousands of them are going to share the exact same low entropy passwords. Thousands of people will use summer 2024. So instead of wasting time and electricity calculating hashes on the fly during an attack, Exactly. A rainbow table is a massive pre-computed database. And an attacker spends months running their GPU farms, hashing every single combination of characters up to, say, 10 characters long.
No.
But they don't just store the plain text and the hash side by side. That would take petabytes of hard drive space.
Right. I've always wondered about that. How do they store trillions of pre-computed hashes without needing an entire data center?
They use a clever mathematical trick called reduction functions. They create chains. They hash a password. Then run a reduction function to turn the hash back into a different plain text. Hash that. Reduce it. Hash it again. Thousands of times. Then they only store the very first plain text and the very last hash in the chain. This compresses the data massively. The resulting file is called a rainbow table because it uses a spectrum, a rainbow of different reduction functions to avoid infinite loops.
That is incredibly brilliant and incredibly malicious. So when the attacker steals your company's database, they don't actually brute force anything at that point.
No calculation required. They simply take your stolen, irreversible hash, run it through their chain logic, and look it up in their rainbow table. It transforms a computationally heavy, time-consuming cracking process into a simple, instantaneous database lookup. They can crack millions of passwords in minutes.
Let me make sure you listening are grasping the sheer scale of this vulnerability. Because hashing is deterministic, meaning the exact same input always produces the exact same output. If I use a super common password, like password 123, my fingerprint is going to look exactly identical to the fingerprint of a million other people who use that same password.
Yes. There will be 1 million identical hashes sitting in the database. The attacker only needs to crack that specific hash once, or look it up in their rainbow table once, and they instantly compromise all 1 million accounts simultaneously. This is exactly why raw, plain hashing is a fundamentally broken defense. It cannot withstand pre-computation.
Wow. Okay. So as a security architect, how do you defeat a pre-computed rainbow table? If the core problem is that identical passwords create identical hashes and hackers use that predictability against us, we have to somehow make sure that every single hash in the database is entirely unique, even if the users choose the exact same password. How is that mathematically possible?
It is entirely possible, and it brings us to our final defense architecture. We move to Section 6, the ultimate defense, salting and work factors.
Salting. It sounds like cooking, but it's cryptography. What exactly is a cryptographic salt?
Salting is the process of appending a unique, highly random cryptographic string of characters to a user's password before the hashing algorithm is applied. This random string is the salt. And the absolute most critical rule of salting is that a brand new, completely unique salt is randomly generated for every single individual user upon account creation.
Okay, let's walk through the math of how this physically defeats the rainbow tables we just talked about. Let's imagine a scenario with two users, user A and user B. They both stubbornly decide to ignore security policies, and they both choose the exact same terrible password, my password.
If the database used raw hashing, both users would generate the exact same fingerprint. The rainbow table cracks them instantly. But with salting, the system intervenes at the moment of creation. When user A types my password, the system's random number generator creates a unique salt, let's say 9F38A8.
So it glues them together.
Exactly. It concatenates them. The system combines the password and the salt into a new string, my password 9F38A8. It drops that combined string into the hash algorithm. The resulting unique hash is saved in the database, and importantly, the salt 9F38A8 is saved right next to it in plain text.
Wait, the salt is saved in plain text. Isn't that a security risk?
Not at all. The salt is not a secret key. It is just a public modifier. Its only job is to guarantee uniqueness. Because watch what happens with user B.
Right, user B also types my password.
When user B hits enter, the system generates a completely different random salt. Let's say X7B21Q. It combines them into my password X7B21Q. It hashes that new string.
And because we know the rule of the avalanche effect, where changing even one tiny character completely scrambles the output into a totally new fingerprint, user A's hash and user B's hash will look completely entirely different in the database, even though their actual passwords were exactly the same.
Precisely. You look at the database and you see two completely random unrelated hashes. And this mathematical trick completely destroys the utility of a rainbow table.
Because a rainbow table relies on pre-computing the hash of my password. But the system didn't hash my password. It hashed my password plus a random string.
Exactly. The attacker's pre-computed table is now utterly useless. To use a rainbow table against a salted database, the attacker would have to pre-compute a brand new terabyte-sized rainbow table for every single unique salt that exists in the database.
Which means if there are 10 million users, they would need to generate 10 million different rainbow tables. Which is mathematically impossible, or at least computationally expensive far beyond reason. It would take centuries and exabytes of storage.
It completely disarms the pre-computed attack. Salting forces the attacker to start from scratch. But we must remember, attackers are incredibly persistent. If they realize their rainbow tables are useless, they won't just give up. They will pivot. They will go back to brute forcing. They will point their massive arrays of GPUs at your salted database and attempt to guess the password and salt combinations billions of times a second.
Because the salt is public, they can just append it to their dictionary words and hash them on the fly. And since algorithms like SHA-256 are incredibly fast, the GPUs can churn through them quickly. So how do we stop that? We need a second layer of defense.
We need work factors. The security industry realized that using general-purpose hash functions like SHA-256 for passwords was a huge mistake. SHA-256 is designed to be as fast and efficient as possible so it can verify large files quickly. But when it comes to password storage, speed is actually your worst enemy. If the algorithm is fast for the server, it is equally fast for the attacker's GPU. We want the hashing process to be intentionally agonizingly slow.
So we use advanced algorithms built specifically for password storage. Key derivation functions like bcrypt, script, and the current gold standard argon2, how do they actually slow things down?
They introduce a configurable cost factor, or work factor. These algorithms are intentionally designed to be computationally expensive. You, as the administrator, can configure the algorithm to force the computer's CPU to run thousands of internal iterations before it finally spits out the hash. You calibrate it so that calculating a single hash takes, for example, 0.3 seconds.
To a human being, a third of a second doesn't sound like much of a defense.
To a legitimate user logging in once a day, a delay of 0.3 seconds is completely unnoticeable. They don't even blink. But think about the math for an attacker. The attacker is trying to guess 10 billion dictionary combinations. If you multiply 10 billion guesses by 0.3 seconds each, you have just turned a brute force hack that would have taken 3 days on a GPU farm into a hack that takes 300 years.
That is staggering, just by adding a tiny delay.
And modern algorithms like Argon 2, which actually won the global password hashing competition, take this defense a massive step further. Argon 2 is designed to be not just slow, but memory hard.
Memory hard, meaning it taxes the RAM, not just the processor. Why does that matter so much?
Because of how hacker hardware works. We talked about how attackers use GPUs because they have thousands of cores. But GPUs have a physical limitation. They have very little memory, or cache, attached to each of those individual cores. Argon 2 exploits this physical weakness beautifully. When Argon 2 calculates a hash, it doesn't just do math, it generates a massive block of data in the computer's RAM and makes unpredictable jumps around that data block, forcing the system to keep the whole block in active memory.
Oh, this is brilliant. So if Argon 2 demands, say, 1 gigabyte of RAM to calculate one hash, and a GPU core only has a few megabytes of memory,
the GPU core literally starves. It physically cannot perform the calculation quickly. It has to constantly reach out to the main system RAM, which introduces massive physical latency. A memory hard function effectively renders a multi-million dollar GPU cracking farm completely useless. The attacker is forced to use standard CPUs, which are thousands of times slower.
That is a profound strategic shift. I mean, think about the philosophy of that for a second. We live in a technological age where the singular goal of human progress is to make our computers process things as fast as possible. We demand faster phones, overclocked processors, fiber optic internet. Speed is God. But when it comes to the deepest, most foundational layer of cybersecurity, protecting the very keys to our digital identities, we intentionally engineer software to drag its feet. We deliberately force computers to slow down. We literally weaponize inefficiency to protect ourselves.
We weaponize inefficiency. That is a fantastic summation. In security economics, you don't necessarily have to build an unbreakable wall. You just have to make the computational cost of climbing the wall far higher than the value of the data sitting behind it. If it costs an attacker $10 million in electricity to crack a database worth $10,000, the encryption has succeeded.
Okay. Let's take a breath and bring this incredible architecture all together for our outro. We have covered a massive amount of ground today for your week 6 syllabus. We started by looking at the grand overarching strategy of zero trust, this modern mandate that we must never trust, always verify.
And that verification begins at the front door with authentication, or authent, rigorously proving your identity, not just with a credential, but by binding it to the context of your interaction. But simply proving who you are is not enough. We need strict sequential rules about what you are allowed to touch, which is authorization, or auth-z.
And to prevent our network from devolving into an unmanageable, tangled web of permissions, we structure that auth-z using role-based access control, or RBAC. We stop assigning permissions to individuals and instead assign them to structured roles using many-to-many relationships, utilizing dynamic sessions to enforce the principle of least privilege.
But when an organization grows so complex that roles begin to violently explode due to situational requirements, we transition to, or layer on, attribute-based access control, or ABADL. We implement policy engines that evaluate the user, the resource, and environmental context like time of day and IP address in real time before granting access.
Yet we realize that the entire sprawling fortress, all those carefully crafted roles and dynamic attributes, rests entirely on verifying your identity through a password. And we learned the golden rule of databases. We never encrypt passwords, because encryption is a reversible process relying on a vulnerable key. Instead, we hash them using one-way cryptographic algorithms to verify the fingerprint without ever knowing the secret.
And finally, to protect those stored hashes from being decimated by pre-computed rainbow tables or brute force dictionary attacks, we must append completely unique random salts to every single password. And we process them through intentionally slow, memory-hard algorithms like Argon 2, weaponizing inefficiency to break the attacker's hardware.
It is a breathtaking, multi-layered defensive architecture. But before we completely sign off on this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something for you to mull over as you continue your week 6 studies. We talked extensively about weaponizing inefficiency to slow down the attacker's hardware. But what happens to this entire architecture when the attacker's computer becomes fundamentally, physically different?
Oh, you are talking about the quantum horizon.
Exactly. As quantum computing looms on the horizon, we are looking at machines that don't process binary ones and zeros, but use quantum bits to evaluate massive probabilities simultaneously. They threaten to instantly perform calculations that would take standard supercomputers thousands of years. Will the mathematical puzzles of one-way hashing, salting, and memory hard work factors survive a post-quantum world? Will a quantum computer running Grover's algorithm just slice through argon 2 like a hot knife through butter? Or will we have to completely abandon passwords, hashes, and classical cryptography as we know it in favor of entirely new biological or behavioral identifiers? It is a paradigm shift that your generation of security architects will have to solve. Something really fascinating to ponder.
The landscape of cybersecurity is never static. The diagnostic waters will only get murkier, and the math will have to evolve.
So true. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. And now, a required message and acknowledgement for this syllabus session. Full credits to the technical and management team of Canrail Builders Development Corporation, East Pacific Computer College, Canrail Media Productions, and Canrail Information Technology Solutions, headed by Dr. Raul C. Gakkasan and his team. Raul Jr., Nico, Chech, Timmy, Kathleen, Kayla, Micah, JL, Nicole, Roseanne, Tom, Catherine, Jocelyn, Mylene, Marjorie, Angelo, and Joanne.
Until next time, keep questioning the invisible systems you use every single day.
And remember, whether it's a broken arm on an x-ray or a zero-day vulnerability in your enterprise database, well, sometimes the most important thing isn't just knowing what is broken, but deeply understanding why and how the underlying architecture allowed it to break in the first place. See you on the next Deep Dive.